Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Brennan. Welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winna Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi, Guy. What's up?
Hey, Margaret. Everybody's in summer clothes. Oliver and I are both in shorts. Oliver is rocking an adorable madras. And you've got yourself like a little like rompery thing.
Mm-hmm. Jumpsuit.
Winter has an adorable like wheat gold t-shirt dress.
Yeah.
You guys, it's 108 in the valley and we're all dressed for it.
Yeah.
We're not in the valley, but some of us had to be
there.
It's
a fucking nightmare.
And of course, academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hey, Guy. The three of you seem to have had a wonderful time at Max FunCon, and I'm very sad not to have been able to join you all.
You really missed a good time.
I know.
I missed you all.
I had never been to Lake Arrowhead. I did not realize that there was a mountain that you could drive to the top of, and it would be a different season than it is everywhere else.
Exactly.
Do they just hand out free water to everyone, like those big jugs? Right?
No? It was weird. You had to like drive through a cloud to get there.
Yeah. It was your fog cover.
Yeah.
Very
San
magical. Francisco type fog cover.
But we had a super fun show with Ricky Carmona and Corin Tucker, and they were both really great and like elevated the conversation really nicely.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Yes. Thank you for doing that, you guys.
Coming up on this week's show, we're going to send our love to Orlando and the entire state of Florida because they've been going through a lot in the past couple of weeks, and we wanted to talk about and celebrate the pop culture that they make, the pop culture about them. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
So part of the reason why the main reason why I couldn't make it to Max FunCon was because I was on the East Coast last week, including visiting the oldest Chinese restaurant in Hallowell, Maine, known as Lucky Garden, which has been there since 1991. It is run by my uncle, so I'm being very biased in talking about it. But I don't know, for someone who's really interested in Asian American history, I don't know why it never occurred to me to talk to my own family members about their particular family history in terms of how it was that my uncle ended up opening a Chinese restaurant in a town of 2000, which, according to my cousin, is behind San Francisco as the American city with the highest per capita percentage of LGBT residents.
Wow. Oh, really?
Well, again, it's a town of 2000, so you don't like need a ton of people in order to do it, but still, that's pretty notable.
That's very
notable.
Interesting.
And he ended up, you know, this is a very familiar story to how do all these Chinese restaurants end up in different small towns around the U.S., and my uncle's examples is really no different than many other people's, which is that he knew somebody who was already operating a restaurant in Maine, and his friend basically said, you should come out to Maine because there's no competition. You can clean up here. And that's how my uncle relocated his family in 1991 to a small town right outside of Augusta, Maine, and has had the most – I forget how many years in a row it's won the award for the best Chinese restaurant in the greater Augusta area, which is a great honor. Though if you look at the greater Augusta area, it's you know, you got to take that into context. But
it is a fascinating aspect of the immigrant experience. My first time in Florida was for a Quiz Bowl tournament, and then we were in Gainesville, and then we went to Ocala because a girl on a Quiz Bowl team that we knew was from the family that ran the Chinese restaurant in Ocala, and we got to experience an aspect of northern Florida that, you know, most people don't.
Our diaspora is legion.
Has Stephen King ever eaten at your uncle's restaurant?
You know, I didn't think to ask. I don't think he's anywhere. I don't think Hallowell's near where King's Haunts are, if I recall. Not that I know the geography of Maine very well. But I feel like King's actually in some rural northern part of Maine, and this is really more central.
Okay. But, well, yeah. I'll accept that.
Yeah.
Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about last night's episode of Game of Thrones, which really did pitch the show to a whole different level.
Wow.
It was this giant battle scene, the Battle of the Bastards. Jon Snow and Ramsay Bolton came head-to-head at last, which has been building and building and building for shows and shows and shows. And the battle scene was truly epic. And unlike a lot of battle scenes that I've ever experienced, I was actually able to 100% track what was going on in every single second. And not only track it, but be blown away by the photography and the acting and certain choices that they made. It was directed by Miguel Sapochnik, who also directed last season's Hard Home. So he's got a history of creating these really amazing battle scenes. But there's this 5 minute or so sequence where you just see Jon Snow almost get stampeded. And it really doesn't let up. It just shows you, like, constant battery of humans, like, falling on top of him and horses and blood. And it's just, it's gory, but it's so, there's a lot of integrity to it. It's like, this is what battle is. This is what war is.
Human bodies becoming an impediment on the field is something you read about in history books, but you never see in movies about this shit.
No.
And it really was awesome once there was the gigantic pile of people. And last night really also took a distinctly female power-oriented turn that we hadn't seen before, including, like, we're now finally getting a Sansa Stark who's all grown up and is, like...
All grown up.
Yeah. Reading about her as a little girl who was dreaming of just sort of being a fancy lady, and that's what a fancy lady is, and then you sort of, like, saw Marjorie Tyrell and saw these more sort of, like... operating ladies, and now realizing her, like, making a really, really savvy strategy suggestion with no knowledge of the military, just saying, don't do what he wants you to do.
Right. He's going to try to trick you and play with you, and that's his whole MO, and don't fall for it. And yeah, it's amazing because we've just seen her grow up in a really savage way. Like, the things that have happened to her are cruel baptism by fire, but it's now paying off in this certain kind of way.
I'm wondering, with Game of Thrones, and again, this is spoken to someone who doesn't watch it, is part of its reputation is that it's very unsentimental. Your favorite character will probably die at some point, unless your favorite character is Jon Snow, I guess. But I'm wondering, in terms of narrative payoff, does it do comeuppance well? Because I don't want to spoil it, but I know there's a big comeuppance moment in last night's episode. And it seems to me that as much as they torture their fans, not to mention the characters, when it comes to someone getting their due, they really get their fucking due.
I've been feeling like in the last season, they are getting maybe a touch more sentimental and that they're not killing off characters that are obviously beloved, and they are giving those characters a real chance to get revenge often. I mean, last night was a huge rape revenge fantasy. I mean, that was on, like, Kill Bill levels of, like, payback.
I didn't think about it that way.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and part of what her strategy, you know, the strategy that she tells to Jon Snow is gleaned from her awful knowledge of knowing what Bolton is like.
And there was a dear cost to what happened that Sansa was able to make in a much more clear and sort of, like, surgical kind of way than Jon Snow was. And it really, the more you see the heart of Game of Thrones and the way that it isn't moral, but it is very political, is really fascinating, because she said, there is something that we have lost. And even though it is not lost yet, it is lost. So accept it is lost. And he just couldn't, because he's a boy and he thinks he can influence things. And she's a girl who is tortured and raped by that man and understands you have to play the hand that is dealt you. Mm. It was a great hour of television. Winter, what are you all about?
Maybe I'll start watching.
I mean, you could watch this episode. Like, anyone could watch this episode not knowing a thing about Game of Thrones and not having to
That's
really
what
invest.
They all say.
No. This one, truly.
Last week, I got invited to see the Neon Demon at Cinespia, which is the outdoor cemetery screening that happens all during the summer in Hollywood Forever in Hollywood. And I didn't do too much research about it. I know it's the Nicholas Winding Refn movie. He directed Drive. So it got a weird reaction over in France. And then it's coming out this week. And Elle Fanning's in it. And Keanu Reeves makes a cameo. And I just didn't know what I was walking into, which is always, I think, the best way to walk into a movie, which is incredibly hard in this new millennium.
Yeah.
Out of control. This movie is so far out of control that there was no way for me not to love it and steer it back into.
What
my
is
direction.
It about? Give me.
It's about. I don't want to spoil it. But how do I? I'm trying to describe it the way it's being described by critics, so people don't get spoiled. But basically, Elle Fanning plays a young model who comes to Los Angeles to seek her fame and fortune. She becomes the it girl. And in believing her own power, she's consumed by it. So that's really all I can say, because anything else would be basically like a spoiler. It's gory. It's graphic. It's there's necrophilia. There's cannibalism. There is a mountain lion in it. But that's what the story.
Winter, I think you might like Game of Thrones, and don't realize.
Yeah, I mean mountain lions, cannibalism,
necrophilia,
but is there enough makeup and fashion in it? You need to give me the makeup and the fashion, and then we're
there.
I mean,
if you like ravaged furs and gaunt people that haven't had
that's
a
basically
good meal,
this movie
been living on tack forever.
Okay, basically that's this movie. Yeah. It was the story itself is thin. We've all seen this story before, but the visually, this man can make anything look amazing. It's visually stunning. Beautiful, beautiful. And I went to the after party, which was amazing, and everybody was walking around in a daze because they were trying to still process what they'd just seen. But it's like a tight 98 minutes, and it's like incredible.
Oh, I like that. I like when a movie's nice and short.
Nice and short. Taught. And Jenna Malone is in it, and she is just so walking in Laurie Metcalf's footsteps. I mean, she is.
I'm so skeptical of any movie about somebody who was destroyed by their ambition or destroyed by their success. I mean, I just, like, there was one really good Priyanka Chopra Bollywood movie about her trying to become a model, and she had a drink of alcohol and then destroyed her. But I get tired of those.
It was, I'm going to be honest
with
you.
Does it hit too close to home, guys?
I was going to say.
Look, my modeling career made me what I am today.
I mean, Neon Demon is not that subtle in terms of his title.
No.
But, I'm into it, though.
Like
that name.
I was thinking when sat down and I wrote it down that I was going, the only reason I'm mentioning it is because I want everybody that listens in the group to go see it and sort of give me what they take away from it, because it's very on the nose.
I will definitely see it.
It's letting you know practically from jump, this is going to be carnivorous in nature, and it's basically what Los Angeles is about. I mean, it's basically a love letter to L.A.
Okay.
With necrophilia.
Yeah, right. With necrophilia.
Awesome. Then I'm fine with that.
Fine.
Sold.
You guys.
Good.
We have an extra special all about this week, because we have a millennial minute from our own producer, Christian Duenas.
Christian.
And that's all you get, a minute.
Who went to the Electronic Entertainment Expo this week to learn about what's going on in video games. Hey, Christian. Hey, Christian, what are you all about this week?
Well, I went to E3 last week on Tuesday and Wednesday. Didn't go Thursday, but it was a ton of fun.
So what were the big concepts this year? What were people buzzing about?
Virtual reality was basically the biggest thing. I've heard of it a lot. I've never tried it out.
And you said at South by Southwest this year, VR was really what was going on.
Yeah, super huge.
Yeah, it's really weird, because for me it doesn't make a lot of sense, because the amount of time and money and space that you need doesn't really like justify like the benefit or whatever.
So it was mostly gaming applications of VR?
Mostly. I tried out this game. I tried out the Oculus for the first time, and that was really cool, sort of. It felt kind of gimmicky, but at the same time, It was cool. You know what I mean?
It's a good gimmick.
But what other applications were there, Christian, you were telling me earlier?
So there was a booth for Naughty America, and Naughty America is a porn company. And they had They had VR porn right there. And
do they have applications?
I did not try it out, but
okay.
Why did you bring this up then?
Because I want to see like the spectacle of just like.
I don't understand.
So, okay.
You to explain a little bit.
Okay, I will. Don't worry. So, I went to this booth. Didn't want to go there because I feel a little weird, but there was a big line here. There was like a lot of people waiting to experience porn in VR.
So, it was a dude with like goggles on.
Yeah. So, you basically get to choose what you want to do. Like, you could be receiving or giving, I guess. And I've heard, it's like... From what I've heard, and from what I've read, you're like, since it's real people, like, it's just a video where you can, like, look around and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just seeing this person get plowed, and you're just like, you just have your goggles on, and you're just like, oh, yeah, this is pretty cool or whatever. And
you can look around and check out, like, how dirty the floor is.
Yeah.
And the fluffer and the catering.
Yeah. And, okay, so I...
It wouldn't work for gay porn because they're all shot in a garage.
Is that a rule? That's what? A rule.
No, it's just a general truth that, okay. Like, most of the time, it's like, sometimes they rent a ski chalet, but most of the time, just a corner of a garage was painted to look like a locker room.
What I'm trying to figure out is, when they're actually shooting the video itself, is there someone wearing, like, a crown of cameras that have a 360 pan
yeah,
view?
Yeah, I think so.
And like, they're having sex at the same time? Because that seems mad awkward, but okay.
Yeah.
Those are professionals.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Christian, more importantly, what games were we talking about this year?
Okay, so the biggest thing that they had in this E3 was Zelda. Like, it's
what I heard.
Yeah. And what's the title
like
of the Zelda?
Classic Zelda?
This is a new one called Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. Uh-huh. I did not get to try it out because the line was legitimate. Like, it was 4 hours long just to try out this game.
Breath of the Wild sounds like the porn.
Well, they have that too.
Winter and I are pushing and worked for G4. That means when we went to E3, we went to the front of the line
exactly.
when we needed to.
I don't care who you are. I do the same thing at Comic-Con. Question. Mm-hmm. I saw the beta version of Friday the 13th. Did you get the chance to see that?
Yeah, that was an alpha, but yes.
Was an alpha?
Mm-hmm.
This is a video game.
It's a video game.
Where you play as Jason and you're killing the camp counselors.
Oh,
it's
wonderful. Wonderful.
Brutal.
Yeah.
That is a great concept.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. I mean.
I love the voiceover of the mom.
Yeah.
She's like, Jason, do it. Yeah. Get her.
What?
It's creepy.
It's pretty, like, out there. But it's it looks fun.
Well,
I don't know
if you're Jason, then my question is, who's the big boss?
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe
I guess
Freddy pops.
I'm
in.
Sorry. It's the blonde, big titted girl who didn't have sex.
That's
She's
right.
the hardest one to get to. All right. Well, Christian, thank you very much for your millennial minutes.
Thank you for having me.
And please continue to report back about video games and other things that relate to you and your world and your generation.
I really need to talk about something other than video games because the only two times I've been here is just
this
shit about video games.
This is what you know, man.
All right.
We just want you as a one-dimensional millennial.
Expand your brand. All right. This week, there were a couple of terrible things that happened. But one of them was the Pulse shooting in Orlando, and I'm sorry to take it down for a second. But the thing that I was the culture I was most about this week was like the social media response or the response of gays sort of like making noise about this. Like after Donald Trump said that he would be better for the gays, that LGBTQ hates Trump party. And hashtag ask the gays, because he said ask the gays. We're just responding with GIFs and sass and like all of the can you believe that this fucker is doing this in a way that was really, really satisfying to have somebody sort of like try to railroad this narrative into like implying that somehow the answer to this was bigotry and hating Muslims.
Right.
And then a couple of pieces that people wrote, like Dave Holmes wrote a piece for Esquire that was basically just talking about the extent to which anytime gay people go out, it is a politicized experience. Mm-hmm. And sort of what was interesting was the way that these things were about sort of explaining marginalization and violence and also a community that people don't necessarily think about. Like there's a sassy gay guy on a TV show that you've watched that's played by a straight guy and was written by a straight guy. And so questions like, you know, like why should we care about these people who were out at a club? You know, like the fact that clubs kind of are the one place where we can come together was, you know, needed to be said. Or there was a guy in Britain who was, like, on a news show, and I forget his name. I should have written it down. But, like, he was with two journalists who kept construing it as being either a question of terrorism or of gun control. Mm-hmm. And when he tried to say, like, also one of the things going on here is that everyone hates gay people. And, like, you know, whether this guy was getting it from his dad or the society that surrounded him. Owen Jones. Thank you very much, sir. And he got up and just walked off of the show because he would not participate in it. And as a people who have been expected to sort of like be in the room but not making noise for most of time. The fact that people made noise to challenge the way that this story was being construed. And also, like, Jeffrey Self, a friend of mine, just did a live stream for like 5 hours where he invited like gay artists to like come over and just do stuff and to just sort of like have a moment online, but collectively to sort of like, you know, do some self-care. And I really appreciated that we are generally scared of making noise about stuff because it's always like those people, they're disgusting or whatever. Just that it will go wrong, that people will tell us we're doing it wrong. And it was nice that people were so shocked by what happened, they couldn't be quiet.
Were you surprised? And this is me saying this as not being a gay person, but I was surprised by how much people were supportive. I was expecting it to just go full throttle and be disgusting, and I was going to be really upset about that. And then I woke up the next day, and then you're the first person I thought of because you left Max FunCon because it was Pride weekend.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, like, waking up the next day and just Margaret and I were talking about it at breakfast, it was just like it just cast like a shadow over everything, and it still kind of lingers.
Well, it's weird because it is Pride Month and we keep having Pride.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. And I'm wondering if you felt – do you feel – like there is much more support than there's I don't know, but I feel like there is, and I'm trying to inclusive of it because I feel like even from the Black community, which are notoriously shady and can occasionally be shitty about homosexuality, I saw there were overwhelmingly like, you know, like what the like, come on now. Well, like they became a part of it because they felt like as a marginalized community, we needed to just actually accept that this is terrorism because of homophobia.
It was very strange because there were sort of like the standard politicians who tweeted like they're reaping what they're sowing. And then they all took it down. And the Republican Party line, I mean, there was the very strange thing that Donald Trump gave a monstrous speech about like how this was all to be blamed on Muslims. Mm-hmm. That was also one of the most gay inclusive speeches that any national Republican has ever given, which gets back to the fact that yeah. I was stunned that people were more responsive to this mm-hmm. than maybe they were those 23 dead kids in or however many there were
in Newtown.
But and the weird pallor of like that it was a Afghani American yeah. who did it. And the way that this ties into narratives of the way we talk about terrorism and stuff just kind of made me a little sick to my stomach
right.
because it's like, you know, God knows, like, you know, we can't just be pivoting from one wedge issue to the next.
Exactly.
Guy, I wanted to ask you about your own contribution to that conversation, which is your op-ed in the New York
Times. I did
not
bring this up to talk about that.
I know you didn't,
yeah.
but I still think it's valuable to include because
sure.
you brought up many aspects of what it felt like to be celebrating Pride on that day. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, how it was to write that and then what your reactions were to it.
It was very strange because, you know, they arrested a guy in Santa Monica who
yeah.
they said had guns and stuff. And it turns out he probably wasn't trying to do something, but you just didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt weird. And I think everybody was surprised by how normal it felt, like as things went on, and that felt really good. And it, you know, it's the thing I talk about, that like we don't sort of do things as quietly and dignifiedly and nobly as other civil rights movements have done stuff, and to a lot of people that seems like frivolity and ridiculousness, but it is like who we are and what we do. Mm-hmm. And so that was how much it was important for me to be around other gay people and hear like them having a good time and saying real heartfelt thoughts, but also terrible dark jokes and things was really valuable for me. And the number of straight people who reached out and the number of gay people who reached out, because it was just sort of a weird and horrifying time. Like, I have to tell you, more than any, like, Anderson Cooper reading the list
yes.
of
oh my God.
Victims got me so bad.
Ooh.
And then also their professions, just like that they worked at amusement parks and that they were baristas and that those were 22-year-old Latino boy, gay boys in like in Orlando was just so real.
That was their that was their night. Like that was their night. They were leading. They were waiting for that night that whole week. They were waiting for that night that whole week.
Yeah,
that was their night.
So it was good to be reminded of having wonderful people around and feeling very sorry for people who died for the audacity of existing. that's an up note. All right, you guys.
I love you.
Love you too, Guy.
I love you guys. We're going to be sending some love to Florida. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about Florida and pop culture after this.
Hey guys, this is Adam Conover. You may know me from my True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything. Well, guess what? Now we're doing a podcast version right here on Maximum Fun. What we do is we take all the interesting, fascinating experts that we talk to for just a couple minutes on the show, and we sit with them for an entire podcast, really going deep and getting into the fascinating details of their work. Find Adam Ruins Everything wherever you get your podcasts or at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell and I love gay men.
Margaret Wappler and I love lesbians.
Oliver Wang and I'm polyamorous.
Something like that. Pansexual. I'm Oliver Wang. I love everyone.
And I will say...
See, that seems cheap now, so...
I love trans people and the genderqueer.
Okay,
I especially love the genderqueer because there's just a swagger that comes along with saying, you play your little gender games. I got my own thing going on.
Can I say something really quick? Do you know Donut Time is closed?
Oh, no, really?
I don't know what happened.
Oh, you're talking about Donut Time from Tangerine.
Tangerine.
Yeah, like sort of.
Must have made a ton of money and said, fuck it.
I don't know. Like, I like driving past that and being like, I am in an amusement park for this movie.
Exactly.
Okay, Winner, why do you love Florida in pop culture?
The thing about Florida that I've always seemed to notice since I was a kid is that Florida just has sort of like the same aesthetic. Like, you're wearing shorts, you're wearing, like, floral prints or, like, house jackets. And I feel like for the longest time in pop culture, it was older people, senior citizens, is where they went to retire. And I feel like it had to go to the extreme once the 80s came along. You know, it was an entertainment place, but it was more entertaining for older generations. And now, ever since, I feel like the 80s... Especially with Scarface.
The 80s were kind to Miami.
The 80s were very kind to them.
The 80s really brought Miami to us. Like when we were sort of like putting together our document about this, like Margaret brought up like Golden Girls and Miami Vice as like first introduction to Florida. And I realized for me it really did dominate my understanding of what Florida was. Retirement place, but also sexy cocaine place.
Right, right, right.
I've said this before on the show, but I really do think the aspect of, like, you go to Florida to party and to die is really important in one's understanding of Florida.
I think a text I really enjoy, a film, why did I call it a text? Something I really enjoy that is very Florida is the film Miami Rhapsody, which was a rom-com from the early 90s made by David Frankel, who went on to give us, like, The Devil Wears Prada and stuff. And when it happened, it was this exciting moment of, oh, he's going to be a new Woody Allen, back when that was like still a compliment. And it was like a fun, sexy little rom-com, but was full of big leaves and like turquoise and coral colored things, and was just a really charming sex comedy starring Sarah Jessica Parker that was as talky and fun as New York Jews, but like... the sexiness of Antonio Banderas is around.
And Naomi Campbell telling Kevin Pollak, fuck off. Remember that?
Yeah.
One of my favorite movies is Scarface. Scarface for all the reasons why. But it was barely even filmed in Florida. But that, to me, set the tone for how I thought Florida was going to be.
Which was what?
Because I felt like it was one of those places that was just teeming with Hispanic people. And everybody was out in the streets hustling, and I felt like everybody was trying to get something. That was the American dream, and the American dream didn't start there, but it was paced enough so that you were, just because you weren't in New York where you feel like you have to do it every single day, in Miami you can kind of take your time with it. And so that was my first visual introduction to Florida.
Well, one of the weird things about Florida is, like, it's this East Coast part of the Sun Belt. It's a place that we've had as part of our country since always, but it wasn't until we had air conditioning that we cared. And so I feel like it really did come out of nowhere. Like, there was a Disneyland here before they thought to put one there. Oliver, what defines Florida for you in pop culture?
Well, I thought Miami Vice like a lot of you, but then I was trying to remember, what did I think of Miami based on Miami Vice? And I think because so much of it takes place where drug deals are going down, which is always indoors and at night.
Yeah.
Like, I mostly just think of dark spaces, and that doesn't really give you a sense of the city. And so the more I thought about it, yeah.
Let's respect the fucking opening credit sequence, though.
Sure. I was going to say,
women in thongs, hi-li. Like, you know, and like ibises. Yeah. Margaret, we've got this rich world of very Florida writers. You've got, like, Dave Barry doing sort of, like, personal essays that always seem to have a mango tree that's shitting all over his lawn. You've got Carl Hiaasen and Elmore Leonard sort of, like, really romancing this place that is, like, full of places for crimes to happen that no one can see. Why do you feel it is such a ripe territory for writers?
I think a lot of different things converge in Florida that is great for writers to tap into. There is something about Florida that seems to attract a certain dark, seedy underbelly of America. Like, the phrase that Florida is the drain pipe of America really, like, stands out to me, that, like, sort of everything that is supposed to be thrown out or washed away, like, dribbles down there. And so I think there is a lot of, like, crime that goes on there, a lot of drug trafficking, whatever. And then you also have this, like, beautiful landscape. You have this environment there that's, like, the Everglades and the swamps. And, like, I mean, everything about it is really beautiful and rare, but Florida hasn't protected it very well. And I know Carl Hiaasen, for instance, like, writes a lot of books about how the environment is constantly being ravaged by its own people.
Yeah.
And then there's the fact that the tourism industry also is such a huge factor down there. And it's this thing that, like, keeps the state afloat, and they also hate it.
Yeah.
Like, so many of the, like, sort of villains in Carl Hiaasen's books are the tourists that are coming down there and just, like, trampling blindly on everything. And he does not like Disney World, which I think a lot of true blue Florida people don't.
Right.
But Winter, let us speak openly and honestly of Orlando, this place full of dreams that somehow took Disney World and turned that into the Disney Channel and then turned that into a machine for making boy bands.
Exactly. Now, the thing about Disney and them going into, they obviously saw something in this plot of land, because so many people have entered our consciousness because via that channel.
Yeah.
Ryan Gosling, Christina Aguilera, Justin Timberlake.
And it was the difference of the fact that, like, Los Angeles was already happening here.
Yeah.
They were able to go and get...
It was easy. It was an easy way for them to get there.
A shit ton of land that they could control.
Yeah.
We all like to talk shit about Celebration Florida. I mean, they have Celebration Florida, which is their little community that they can just sort of, like, run like a fascist state.
Sure.
And then Scientology has Clearwater that they do the same
thing
with.
Right.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, I mean, I just, you know, it was one of those, the reason why I wanted to go to Disney World was more about Nickelodeon and Universal Studios than it was ever about Disney. I'm not a big Disney head like most kids from my era were. I could give two shits about it. We went a couple of times. It was completely National Lampoon vacation. And my dad's like, I got cheap tickets and August. Well, guess what? That's when hurricanes come. That's why they were cheap. But, you know, I really was obsessed with the child stars of that era in the mid to late 80s who ultimately became huge megastars. And I wanted to, I just was dying to go down there and be kind of become a part of that world, but it was too far away. But it also, it's like you almost kind of like you said, Guy, have to cheer them on because LA was too far away from that for them.
Yeah,
and this seemed like the most logical, like, you know, step into that direction.
Orlando is somewhere in between Los Angeles and Branson. Like, there is a way that sort of the vision it is presenting, like that 90s boy band vision, is something that has a lot of Southern Christianity and hominess to it that, like, feels more family friendly.
Yeah.
Do do you find this charming, disgusting, or both?
Well, you know, this came up in the past week because besides the, you know, the horrific Orlando shooting, there was also the really freak incident where a gator snatches a two-year-old on the Disney World property.
How was that not Imagineered? I think we all assume anytime we're on a Disney property, absolutely everything is like Imagineered so that nothing will ever happen to us
and,
like that.
And I think that that's the thing that, that was most shocking is that, I mean, if this happened in the Everglades, then okay, that's gators being gators. But we disassociate Disney, especially with that massive Disney World complex and machine that you were talking about. We just assume that that level of control is so high that the idea that, you know, an alligator can sneak onto the property and kill somebody seems beyond our ability to imagine because we just don't think of Disney as having not having control over this.
But they have control over so – I mean, they
have
control
over so much. But you know what? Right. The state belongs to gators. People are just borrowing it for now.
100%.
Like, there is something so compelling about being in those places where, like, nature's pushing back.
Yeah.
You know? Like, mangrove forests are still kind of the ocean, you know? Margaret, what do you think of as a definitive piece of Florida culture?
Well, I just watched Spring Breakers by Harmony Korine. And
interesting.
Shout out to James Franco in that.
Oh, my God. James Franco. I mean, I know a lot of people beat up on him for being like some kind of...
Riffraff.
And a jack of all trades, master of none kind of person. But I really respect him as an actor in that movie. And the whole thing is basically this sort of... decrepit dreamscape that takes place in St. Petersburg. And Harmony Korine went down there and hired several, you know, hundreds of extras from the actual, like, spring break scene there. And it really taps into the dark underbelly of that spring break culture that I think is part of Florida's legacy for better or worse.
A much more Disney-fied version of it that we experienced as teenagers watching MTV's Spring Break really did help influence my understanding of this place as like beaches that were cleaner and whiter than the ones I experienced in California, and that did have this sort of like all-out balls-to-the-wall teenage fun, but also was my experience of RuPaul. And like for me, like RuPaul in a red one piece is inextricably linked with the Florida coast.
I was just also thinking, you know, we're thinking of sort of almost gentle portrayals of Florida. Unexpectedly was Magic Mike, which really made that space. And a lot of it had to do obviously with the characters and everything with that. But it didn't make Florida seem like a bad place. It seemed like a nice place for people to, you know, work hard and try to blow up and but without the kind of seedy underbelly, even though there was, you know, parts of that with Magic Mike.
One of the things I love most about Magic Mike is it is a rare piece of media that shows you an economy you understand, an economy that relates to the world around you and, you know, like where people are having to do shit to be able to work and survive. And the kind of successes or happinesses that they're looking for are very realistic. Like, when you were talking about Spring Breakers and that very, like, washed out sort of, like, louche feel that it's got, I was thinking about Out of Sight, which, in, like, Soderbergh clearly gets Florida in a very deep way that it is full of saturated colors, but too much sun and everybody's a little bit sweaty and dirty.
I feel like you go to film things in Florida when you want to use a lot of neon.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Like Skittle colors. Yeah. Like if you want Skittle colors of the rainbow, you got to shoot something in Florida.
I think that Mike Nichols and Elaine May realizing that your answer to the Côte d'Azur was going to South Beach, Florida. Like even though The Birdcage is a fucking stage play, the bits of Miami that they give you and Nathan Lane's outfits really do present a place that is gendered differently.
Right.
Where gender works differently. And Glenn Weldon talking about Jane the Virgin on Pop Culture Happy Hour, like he's married to a Cuban man and really talks about the way that Jane the Virgin gets that like gender works differently in this space because you've got all of these men from the Caribbean and South America and other parts of Latin America where, you know, buttoning more than two of the buttons on your shirt, what, are you running a bank?
You know, there's two movies that I think of when we're talking about like the sort of the desperation guy mentioned, like the not the desperation, but sort of working people doing their thing and striving for something more. And I'm thinking about Striptease, which is Demi Moore's colossal flop.
I did not even think about that, but based on a Carl Hiaasen novel, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Striptease, which is, I think, a wonderful movie. And, I mean, I love Demi Moore. This was, like, at the height when she was getting paid, like, $15 million a picture. And then there was Wild Things, which was Denise Richards, Neve Campbell, Kevin Bacon, Matt Dillon, the high school teacher hooking up with the students, crime caper.
I've still never seen it.
It's amazing.
I almost can't be gay.
like it's the gayest thing ever. Yeah. Okay, and then Kevin Bacon's dick's in it. So listen, there's if you are into that sort of thing, those movies seem to come to life in Florida because it's so you can feel when they're in the swamp in Wild Things and they're playing with the gators, you can feel the gators and you can see you can't get away from that layer of sweat covering someone's brow and if they don't have a layer of sweat, I don't believe them.
When you talk about gators, are you still talking about Kevin Bacon's
penis? No. hey now.
What do you know here, Margaret, that you're not telling us?
Let's just say 6 degrees of separation.
Oh. Ooh.
I would like to talk about sex,
I got that.
Sweat, and neon with kind of a weird recommendation if you guys haven't experienced it. But the Tennessee Williams play, Sweet Bird of Youth, they made it an adaptation with Geraldine Page and Paul Newman. But it's this... guy who's basically a gigolo to a washed-up Hollywood actress goes back to the town of the politician whose daughter he gave a venereal disease to try to win her back. And I just love that when Tennessee Williams, like, really was going to, like, the most nut-funky of stories, like a story that was just... full of sex, that was when he dipped into Florida. That, like, Florida exists on the edge of Latin America and of the South and is this place of sort of overlap for those things. It's really interesting.
Right. I was thinking about its borderness in a way, the fact that there is, like, all this Cuban influence and this sort of Latin American push into it. And that has always, I think, scared people a little bit about Florida, that there seems to be this kind of real conflict there between, like, the stalwart white men who have run it, you know, Bush, so forth, and then, like, a different Cuban population. Although you could also make the argument that they've been married in certain ways because the Cuban population is somewhat conservative in Miami, but...
And also, like, a Latin American population that looks differently because they're, like, Jane the Virgin, it's all Venezuelan Americans. And that there is this weird, like, Spanish language, not weird, just alien to me, like, Spanish language media that's all happening in Miami, but is entertaining the people of Venezuela and Colombia and, like, all of these other places that are further, but...
English is like a second language there.
Yeah.
Well, I would just point out, I think in our discussion, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that none of us are from Florida, is that we're really conflating Miami with Florida, where I think Miami is one of those cases where it's sort of a state within a state, and that the rest of Florida that's not Miami is very much not like Miami. And I think that's, I mean, it's, again, it makes sense when people are not from California, they conflate either SF or LA with being the entire state. But in this case, I think Miami has such a particular personality. Yeah, you can extend part of it to the rest of the state, but I also think that there are huge swaths of Florida that have nothing to do with the things that we associate with Miami as a very particular kind of island within the state.
The reason I wanted to go to Miami, I've been to Florida a bunch growing up, but the reason I wanted to go to Miami as a 20-year-old is because of Puff Daddy. Puff Daddy, this was like his playland, and he would go down there with Jennifer Lopez, and I went and saw Madonna there. I took my little sister to see Madonna there when I was 22 years old, and I always had this love affair with being in Florida as an adult of age. I on New Year's I went and saw Boy George. I just always associated Miami with the ultimate party, and growing up in San Francisco, parties just weren't colorful enough for me. So when I went to Black Beach Weekend, that was my first experience with Miami culture, nightlife culture.
I was thinking about this a moment ago as well, which is that I think one of the things that Miami stands out at is that it's a city of excess. But unlike, let's say, Vegas or Los Angeles or New York, which have those associations as well, there's not really a commerce aspect. Like, no. LA is an industry town, right? Vegas has gambling. New York is the center of our economic engine in the U.S. Miami is just excess
of joy,
or of whatever else, but not
and
having
they
to do,
do
with
it. They do it better. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, don't go ahead.
But they do
titties
it.
And cocaine.
Yeah, they yeah, just exactly. do it. They had a club when I was. This is 15 years ago now. They had a club called Bed. It was just beds in a room with music.
This wasn't like from Sex and the City.
No, it's called BED. It
You're
was
right,
called
that was Bed.
Yes.
It was in Sex and the City yes. episode.
Margaret.
You know, I want to go back to Oliver's point about how there's many different Floridas, which I think is absolutely true. I mean, Miami is its own thing, and then the central part of the state is its own thing, and then the panhandle yeah. is something entirely different. So I rewatched an episode of 30 Rock, Unwind You Lax, which isn't actually set in Florida, but it pays major homage to the Parrot Heads. And basically, Liz Lemon and Jack Donaghy are having a fight because she wants Obama to be reelected, he wants Mitt Romney, and they realize that Jenna is this ultimate pawn because she has all this power and sway over this group of people called the Crab Catchers, which are basically Parrot Heads. So let's hear a little bit of their breakdown of Florida.
Now, like any penis, Florida is very complicated. The Cubans in the South, very conservative. I had a lot of expensive cigars put out on me in Miami comedy clubs.
But Central Florida is dominated by Jewish retirees, serial killers, and secretly gay Disney princes, all of whom love Obama. Meanwhile, in Northern Florida,
the only crowds I could never figure out were in Northern Florida. One week they're laughing at me, the next week they're laughing at me.
According to this, the electorate there is impossible to predict. It's a combination of elderly shut-ins, beach bums, bus passengers
who ran out of money, swamp people, and pirates.
First, may I just say, that joke is so good because one of the things that it captures is when you're a gay man living in Florida or Los Angeles and you go out a fair amount, you know a lot of Disney princes. Like, I know two currently working Aladdins.
I feel like that should be on your Facebook somewhere.
Yes! Your Twitter bio.
But yeah. there is that fascinating dynamic that this place that is this amazing world-class city and also this gigantic, you know, third largest state in the United States is also the place where when I was working at Chelsea Lately, if somebody was fucking a park bench, they were fucking a park bench in Florida. Yes, that it was the home, Arizona to a lesser extent, but it was the home of these methed out, terrible people who were, you know, getting rubber cement injected into their buttocks or whatever.
But you know how that started. It started because FARC, which is, God, FARC has used to be relevant.
Drew, what's his name?
Yeah, Drew's site. FARC would label Florida yes. stories. Florida. No other state got the dubious distinction of being called out and tagged by name. It was, you know, news, sports, but and then it would be like,
Florida.
And Florida would be clickbait.
Why?
I've heard that they don't seal records. Like a lot of what happens, like in a criminal ledger sense, just gets like publicized to like journalists and whoever else. Like there's a lot of access.
Yeah.
So. Articles get written.
I'm going to make a cultural argument that Florida is full of people who are looking for a good time. And, like, these are not people who stayed in Ohio where they grew up. It is, like, the place on the East Coast where you go. But that it is also the vast middle parts are nice and cheap. Like, that they are not as prohibitive as Southern Florida or like the fun parts of California are. And so that it leads to a lot of people who were in a band for 9 years then just keeping going and drinking a lot of fortified wine and periodically running across a park bench that they find romantic attraction
I
to.
Think there's so much access to things, though. There's, I mean, the drug. I mean, they pick up drugs off the beach, washing ashore constantly.
Yeah, it did give us, bath salts we got from from Florida.
Don't forget the bath salts.
And the huffing of the fermented feces I thought we also got from Florida.
What?
Oh, God.
Ew. Did I miss
Jankum?
This?
Jankum!
Jankum? Somebody's like named it something.
I gotta
like
Christian,
this
you were
now.
You were very ready with
you
that.
You are ready
Can
on that.
Can you make
that.
A coffee from that? Anyways,
Oliver, any theories on why Florida leads to so many unique news stories?
I mean, I think we've all kind of touched bases on it on some level. I think partly it does draw this really interesting expanse of American and actually really American Caribbean humanity all into one series of locations. I don't have a good working theory around this, but you mentioned Arizona before, and obviously there's Southern California, and there's something about sort of good climate states because people want to go places where they like the climate, but it's not the same people. So you have this really weird stew of different personalities and different demographics intermingling, and that's going to create sort of interesting combustions.
Yeah. Yes, and then tourists just coming in and complicating it even further and not feeling like they really owe the state anything. Like they can just trash it and do whatever they want.
Florida doesn't really lend itself to asking you to hang out. It doesn't really ask you to hang out. You know, so many hurricanes devastated the southern portion of the state in the 80s and the 90s, and things seem ephemeral there. Even housing seems ephemeral there. But the one thing that I found really interesting is, like, growing up, you know, we obviously had Challenger exploded from Cape Canaveral, but Flight of the Navigator was in a huge hugely influential movie, and it also tied into the notion of a child being kidnapped, and Adam Walsh was obviously kidnapped, and that was sent John Walsh into the lexicon because his child was missing, and then obviously the untimely recovery of him. But untimely. He was recovered and it was awful. But Fly the Navigator was such, you know, it was a big Disney movie.
Yeah, that was set in Florida?
It was set in Florida. Oh. And it's time travel, it's Florida, it's space travel, it's all of that stuff. It's having a friend, being kind of an outcast, having your family looking for you. It was just such a collision of like 80s tropes that were occurring at that time that I felt like any kid who saw that movie was like, I want to go to Florida because it looks beautiful. It looks fun. I might get lost. I might get in a spaceship. Who knows?
All right. Let's go around and let's discuss a piece of Florida art that you think either just is definitive of Florida and you love or is something people may not think of as particularly Florida. I'll bring up two things.
Oh.
First one is the HBO J. Roach movie, Recount,
ooh,
which is a really lovely look into like a moment in Florida and its distinctive Florida-ness. And the other is the Junior Vasquez song, If Madonna Calls, which, if you remember, Junior Vasquez assembled from messages Madonna left him on his answering machine while she was harassing him to work with her. And it's just a very Latin voice saying, if Madonna calls, I'm not here. And call me in Miami. And it's a wonderful and amazing song and is one of the greatest works of shade in the American lexicon. Oliver.
I think, and this is me conflating Miami with the rest of the state, but I really think of the legacy of Henry Stone, who ran TK Records out of Miami and was really, I mean, one of the most important figures in the history of Florida music, especially R&B. The number of subsidiary labels that I'm familiar with that I didn't realize until much later that he was in charge of includes things like Alston and Cat and Glades. And basically, there's a whole history of soul music and funk music of the 1970s that were all coming out of basically Henry Stone labels. I think my jam for the week is I chose one of them. But Stone is someone who had such a profound impact on the ways in which Florida became the center. And again, really, we're talking Southern Florida, but it became the center for R&B in the 1970s in the same way that, I mean, we all know about Berry Gordy and Motown in Detroit. I feel like Henry Stone was sort of his equivalent in South Florida, except no one really knows his name outside of, people who really follow Southern or specifically Florida soul.
Good to know. Margaret, what about you?
I don't have a really intelligent answer for this. In fact, I have like the anti-intelligent answer of MTV's Spring Break.
Go for it.
There's nothing to say about it other than that it was just like jiggling asses and bikinis and beer bongs and, I mean, good live performances from all sorts of people you can think of. Destiny's Child and like Beastie Boys and all kinds of people were on there. But I think I would just watch it as a kid. And it started in Daytona Beach. They moved around. You know, later it was like filmed in Cancun and places like that. But It started in Daytona Beach in the 80s, and it just completely informed what I thought Florida was.
Spring break is an East Coast or Midwestern thing.
Yes.
California's fine. Like, sometimes people would go to Mexico or something, but that's more about the fact that you're rich than, like, I need to go somewhere where there's not snow.
Well, right. I do think I went to high school in a place that was close enough to Florida that that was a factor. That was something people would talk about, you know, classmates of mine, like, ooh, maybe we'll just drive down to Florida, because you could burn down there in like 24 hours and be there.
That sounds horrible, driving for 24 hours.
People will do it.
Winner, what about you?
I was going to say Whoomp There It Is, but Whoomp There It Is was filmed in Atlanta. But the this kind of goes back to what I was saying about South Beach, is that Black Beach Weekend was drawn from Freaknik. So I was never going to go to Freaknik. I didn't go to a historically Black college, and I didn't live anywhere near Atlanta. So I wasn't young. Freaknik was right in sort of like my age group. But this was like an extension of Freaknik that sort of went to South Beach. So I think that you know, going there every Memorial Day for 3 years from 20 to 22 was like a big deal for me. But when you said the architecture of art there, all I could think about was the interstate. Because I would always stay in my friend's house, either in South Beach or in Davie, which is in Broward County. And one way or the other, I would rent like a car with a drop top. I just thought I was the shit to be like 20 years old with a good job in Silicon Valley and then like drive barreling through Miami in a drop top convertible. I just thought I was the shit. And that's the only time where I actually felt like I was the shit.
All right, let's work off of this, because I feel like you've hit on something interesting in the way that Miami and thinking that you're the shit go together.
Yes.
Where, like, in New York and L.A.,
they will let you know you're not the shit real
fast.
They
will let you know that you're not the shit. And I would like to bring up two things. One is Art Basel in Miami and just douchebags generally. And then the other is Courtney and Chloe taking Miami.
Oh!
And this experience of having a reality show have a summer break, have a reality show, send off two people to, like, locating just having fun in Miami.
Wasn't it Kim and Chloe?
It was Kim.
Kim was definitely involved. Courtney and Kim.
Oh, it was Courtney and Kim. Okay, I thought for the first season they could not get Kim, but...
No.
It was Courtney and Chloe in the first season.
You're welcome.
No, but the interesting thing about Courtney and Chloe is Courtney was pregnant with her first child, with Mason, and she was going through all this drama. So they were trying to, like, juxtapose the conversation or the narrative around her being pregnant in Miami, opening the Dash store there in South Beach, and then Chloe trying to do something with herself at some point. And they latched onto something that was easy. It's just like what DJ Khaled gives you by being in Miami. Like, it's easy. You know what DJ Khaled's, like, schedule is. It doesn't take very much to know he's going to go to the studio, he's going to get in his Bentley Range, whatever, he's going to jet ski somewhere, eat some food,
but
water his plants.
The easiness is what makes me hate Art Basel.
Right.
Because, like, Miami should be about just Rosie on her ski-doo and, like, having a good time. And this whole sort of, like, we're going to go be rich and fancy and have on a very expensive watches feels so grossly out of place to me. Am I wrong? Thoughts?
I haven't been to it, so I don't know. But I do think any port city that is as cool as Miami is just going to get an art festival sooner or later, whether they want it or not.
I respect that. You guys...
are we done? Because I love talking about Florida.
Yes, please. I was just going to say, please take Margaret's word to heart if you're investing in real estate in any port cities. If you're listening to Pop Rocket, we'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Erin Gibson.
I'm Brian Safi.
And we host Throwing Shade, a weekly look at all the issues that are important to ladies and gays and anybody else who cares about that stuff. And we make funnies.
Yeah, either you care or you don't.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Oliver Wang.
Winter, did you know that every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panelists, what's your current jam? Did you know that?
After 76 episodes, I did not know.
Well, it's true. Do you currently have a jam of any sort?
I do. I couldn't decide because I love... we were talking about Florida. I was really excited, and I was like, all these songs are going to come to me, and all of them did, but most of them are pretty brutal, and I don't know if you guys can handle it. let me know in the comments.
Hit us and see.
I don't know. Hit us and see. But I picked two of my favorites. They're both by Trick Daddy, who is a Miami South Beach rapper. He is a thug.
Damn.
He is really, really obnoxious, okay? He has one song called Shut Up, and then he has another song and called I'm a Thug. I love them both. Which one should I play, Christian?
I really like I'm a Thug.
Okay, we're going to play I'm a Thug. This was the song of the summer in 2001. God, this was in every single club.
Oliver, you got a jam?
I do, and I misspoke earlier. I thought I had picked a Henry Stone-related song, but because we had started with a focus on Orlando, I wanted to pick an Orlando-specific song, which is from DJ Magic Mike and his erstwhile partner, MC Madness. I think this is from probably 1992, 93. And I first read about this, and it's basically an Orlando-based record. Magic Mike was probably the main kind of person representing the Florida-based scene, but in Orlando. I read about some of his stuff in The Source and went and checked it out, which was part of my exposure to just that particular regional sound I was mentioning before. And this song is called Dynamic Duo.
When is this from?
I think this is 1992.
Oh, it was very evocative. I mean, I don't think it's something I've heard before, but it was lovely.
I don't know if that would be typically the word one would apply to it, but that's, I like that you like it like that. That's great.
No, it's great. It's what bled into the dance music of the mid and late 90s. Margaret, what about you?
I'm in full summer jam mode, especially once you put that thread up on the Facebook group. I've been thinking about it.
The official Pop Rocket Summer Jam thread is open on Facebook, so please give contributions. People have been delivering some amazing stuff.
So usually I'm skeptical about remixes because I feel like it'll just shut off the best parts of a song and not retain the best parts. But the remix that Catronata did of Rihanna's Kiss It Better is really a step above the usual remix. Catronata is a Haitian-Canadian producer, and he has an album out called 99.9% that people are really freaking out about. But at any rate, I just thought this remix, like, hits that sweet summer spot so good, especially when it's 108 degrees out.
That is Dancing Under a Tent music. Yes.
Yes. And you can feel like a little pool spray on you listening to that song.
I am very much in summer jam mode, and I've been going through the stuff that people have been delivering. And every year, you guys find such amazing stuff that I never would have found for myself. And this week, Hiko Mitsuzuka nominated Play That Sax by Fleur East. And I had a lot of stuff. Like, I was going through that thread, falling in love with something, and then finding something that I loved even more. And this is just the best. Let's listen to it.
So 80s.
Yes, just wait a moment. You guys, Fleur East is saying that we live in an America safe for saxophones again.
This is, speaking of Florida, this is some Miami Sound Machine kind of sounding shit back here.
But,
holy shit.
But done by like Bruno Mars.
Yes.
We didn't talk about the rhythm is going to get us.
We said nothing of Gloria Estefan or the musical Get on Your Feet. What are we even thinking?
There are many things we left out of the Florida picture, as we cannot be completists.
My friend Chris Schleicher, who did actually amazing work on the Trump Hate Party and Ask the Gays, but he loves to say he went to New York and he saw a musical about a Caribbean immigrant who experienced the American dream, assuming that people will think he is talking about Hamilton, and then talks about how Get on Your Feet, the Gloria Estefan musical, is better than Hamilton.
Oh, it is my God.
Bold words. Bold words.
I enjoy it a lot.
I just had this vision that somewhere in Florida, there's a quartet of people recording a pop culture podcast devoting an episode to California. Like, our doppelgangers are out there. It has to be.
It's like that bizarre episode of Seinfeld.
Oh, How many guavas are on the shirt of the guy in Florida? It's just all leaves and guavas
avocados,
and birds.
Avocados.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wobbler, and Oliver Wang. Oh, and this week, Christian joining us. We post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. You can also find links in the episode description of the podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to MD Account for the 5-star review on iTunes. Only one review on iTunes. I do not want to threaten Margaret Wobbler's life again.
There we go. Again.
So if you guys don't shape up, I might have to. But I'm going to need some more reviews, okay, guys?
Please.
We know we get a lot of listens. We would like a lot of reviews. If you haven't already, please review us. If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topics, you can join in the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We are at Pop Rocket. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the electronically entertained Christian Duenas and Colin Anderson, whose hair is very long right now.
Oh. MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.